Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of July 2017. Welcome to episode 26 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about every comic book I've read since the last time I did one of these brief chats, which should make this approximately the comic books I read during July. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, which I regularly repost on Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. Now, July had 5 Saturdays, and I'm on summer break, so I'm warning you. I read a lot of comic books last month. Now, those posts I mentioned, those are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review or critique, a little more discussion of the books. But first, a little feedback. And this message could have been discussed here or in the quarter bin as it relates to Free Comic Book Day. We talked about this year's Free Comic Book Day on Quarter Bin 98, but we've also talked about some of those books here as well. And we have a lot of Free Comic Book Day talk later in the episode, so I thought this was the right place to go over this message I got from Ernie Lint. Professor Allen and Emily, I wanted to share my FCBD experience. My local comic shop, Captain Blue Hen in Delaware, held its annual bash, which is a lot like a carnival celebration of all things geek. This was the second year that I was able to collaborate with them to create a sensory-friendly experience for individuals with those types of processing needs. I feel it's something more stores should do. Now, I shared with Ernie about Pack Rat Comics, which is one of the shops near us. Now, this is not a shop that I went to on Free Comic Book Day, but I'm on their mailing list, so I saw what they were doing. And for the last hour of May 6th, they did a silent Free Comic Book Day as a safe place for kids and adults who need something less carnival-like than an FCBD experience can be. And around the time that I was having this back and forth with Ernie, I was talking to Stephen Lacey, who's organizing a comic event going into its, I think, second or third year in London. And they are integrating quiet zones and other concepts to make the event accessible to as wide a population as possible. Now, I remember last fall when Em and I went to Baltimore Comic Con. In the materials in the program guide, they did talk about quiet zones and mention that they did not have a specific room set aside. But they did say there was lots of room outside with some, you could have some quiet time outside if you needed that. And when our family was at the Luther 500 event just a few months ago, which we recounted in Dorkness to Light episode 12, again, in that program guide, they talked about that they did have a room set aside, a quiet room, as a sensory lightened room. Now, that one had a religious, you know, overtone to the event, so there were some candles that you could light, there were some small, you know, icons and that sort of thing to make it as much a prayer and meditation room as just a quiet zone, but the point was that it could fulfill both purposes. And as someone who sometimes needs to get away from the hubbub of an event like that, I kind of like that more events and cons are taking note of folks with differing processing styles. I think the catchphrase is neurodiversity. So I shared that with Ernie, and he said it was great to hear that other locations are working to make those experiences as accessible as possible. What made my event so unique, Ernie said, was that not only was I able to control stimulation the entire day, but I was also afforded enough space and a private entrance for individuals to take photos and meet cosplay characters upon request. Ernie also shared a special thank you to the New Ark United Church of Christ for allowing his shop to offer special experiences like this. And of course, anyone who knows our interests, like the aforementioned Dorkness to Light, the fact that a church was involved made me extra glad. Ernie replied that the church not only provided space, but also their kitchen and a break area for volunteers. The pastor's office had a Live Long and Prosper sticker on the door, so I made sure to slide a Star Trek issue from Free Comic Book Day under her door. That's awesome, Ernie. And thanks for sharing all of that. And now onto the books I read last month. And as I do on this show, I'm categorizing or classifying these books. And first up are things that I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. I recently purchased and posted on Facebook a copy of Marvel 2-in-1 21, a team-up between The Thing and Doc Savage. Nicholas Prom saw that and immediately proposed that we cover it together on an episode of his excellent show, Comic Reflections. And just as we were nailing down the details, literally within 12 hours, Rob Kelly and Siskoid talked about that exact issue on an episode of their new team-up podcast. And then, about 12 hours after that, the Fantasticast released their latest weekly episode covering the exact same book. It was crazy. But Nicholas and I have decided to persevere and just consider those shows to be, you know, our opening acts. Nicholas did say he was going to hold the episode for a while, so at least some time could elapse between those two episodes and the time when ours may eventually come out. For an upcoming, and yet to be recorded, episode of Shortbox Showcase focusing on Jack Kirby, I read Forever People 3 and 4 from the original 1971 run. And for an upcoming episode of Warlord Worlds, hosted by the excellent Ruth and Darren Sutherland, I read Superboy starring the Legion of Superheroes 218. And for an upcoming episode of Russell Bragg's DC Comics Presents Show, I read a book that the great Kansan Greg Arujo sent me a while back, DC Comics Presents 82, featuring Superman teaming up with one of my all-time favorites, Adam Strange. And for the formerly Super Secret Project, which is, of course, the epic, Quarterman 100, I read XSE number 2, Night Watch 6, Atari Force 10 through 12, and Cerebus 106. And now, I have read all 100 books. I have not quite yet, technically speaking, recorded about all 100, but I have read them all. And comics I read for listening to podcasts. I read pages 240 to 261 of the Xenozoic trade, the story Lords of the Earth. The excellent Ruth and Darren Sutherland covered this issue in episode 11 of their equally excellent, although slightly difficult to pronounce, Xenozoic Xenophiles podcast. And there was one episode 100 related or episode 100 adjacent book. On part 2 of that episode, I spoke about Justice League Europe 7 with my buddy Terry Colucci. That's part of the Teasdale Imperative storyline that crossed over into JLE and JLA. So when I was rearranging my version of what the aforementioned Greg Arujo calls the never-ending reading pile, I was very surprised to see the next part of that storyline in the pile. I have no idea when or where I picked up Justice League America 32, but there it was, and I gave it a read. It's got Eastern Europe, vampires, the Spectre, Dr. Fate, the Gray Man. So there's a lot going on here. This is Giffen and DeMatteis doing the writing with Adam Hughes on pencils. So there was a lot going for this story on the talent side. Pretty good read, although most of the characters sound pretty similar to each other. They were all quippy and snarky in exactly the same ways. But it wasn't a bad read at all. On to new comics that we read right off the shelves and these are all from DC here in the Rebirth era. There are a number of issue 25s in here, and they were all extra length issues, 4 or 5 extra pages, and then previews. To be honest, the extra dollar was not worth it. If it were 8 story pages, then the math works out. But paying for a preview, which, let's be frank, is a 4-page house ad, I didn't think it was all that great a deal, actually. Green Arrow, 25 and 26. Ali is in prison, and when Emmy comes to break him out, he actually stays behind. And he and his defense lawyer don't quite get along at their first meeting. But we do learn more about the evil plot to take over Seattle and to turn it into Star City. And we see the surprising and dramatic emergence of an unexpected member of the Queen family to rule this new Star City. And in 26, the Flash shows up around Ollie's neck of the woods to investigate a breach of Speed Force energy. And even though he disparages Ollie's abilities and refuses to team up with the Green Arrow for quite some time, he eventually does as they realize that their investigations may be linked. Green Lanterns 25 and 26. Our heroes are still out in deep space missing their old lives and missing the people from their old lives. In 25, the underlying story of Rami and Volthoom comes to fruition, with Volthoom the First Lantern revealing himself and all his power to Jess and Simon. All he needs at this point is Jessica's ring. Now, issue 26 does not have either of our main GLs in it, but it does tell the backstory of Rami and Volthoom. And by backstory, we mean what happened when they first met 10 billion years ago. This answers a few questions, but also poses a few more about the battery and the First Lantern in particular. I really like the way that they've managed to jump around so much in these stories while also telling a single, coherent, cohesive story. Wonder Woman 24 and 25. These are, I believe, the last two issues of Greg Rucka's run on the title. I will continue to read it to give the new team a fair chance, but if it's not to my liking and end up canceling it at some point, I'd be satisfied with 1 through 25 as a very nice, good-sized chunk of issue for my collection. But that's getting a little ahead of myself. What we have in these two issues are Rucka wrapping up some of the major elements of the story so far and leaving the toys in pretty good shape for the next writer. Veronica Kale is not in a good place from the events of the prior storyline, and she and Cheetah have a good throwdown. Diana loses the lasso for a while, and then after getting it back, she and Steve Trevor have a nice romantic evening. DC Bombshells, 29 and 30. There's more here with Hugo Strange doing his crazy experiments in Leningrad. He cloned Supergirl, making a Power Girl, complete with boob window. But she does not really want to serve his evil ends. Lois Lane and the Reaper arrive on the scene to perform a rescue op, and it turns out that they have one more clone to rescue that they weren't expecting, Superman. But Hugo Strange is not allowed to just wallow in his defeat. Killer Frost is none too pleased with the failure, and they need to inform her of Strange's failure. And who is this mysterious head woman in charge? Not the Joker's daughter, not the Baroness, not the General. So we have a new mystery. And the bunny version of John Constantine is back. So it's a win. And then on to the general comic reading that I did. Hackslash 25. I think this one was from Half Price Books, and I'd heard good things about the series, so I figured, what the heck, pick up the last issue. There was the minor technicality of not knowing what was going on, but there was a lot of hacking and even some slashing, so I think I got the gist of it. Mostly I learned that as interesting as the title seemed, that maybe it wasn't quite right for me. From the discount bins at MyLCS, World's Greatest Comics, I recently snagged a bunch of great Bronze Age books. They recently bought a collection that had a bunch of what I call stripped books. They aren't coverless, but the newsstand guy or whoever the retailer was cut off the top inch of the cover as a way of getting, you know, the refund. So a few weeks back, dozens of books from that era showed up. And no matter how valuable the book otherwise could have been, because it was missing this chunk of the cover, and in some cases the first page as well, they had to toss them in the quarterbin. And I felt it my duty to rescue many of them, including Supervillain Team-Up number 7. This was a great read, despite the fact that it had a little too much Fantastic Four in it for my taste. Now, at this point, Namor is under Doom's rule, and he has just made diplomatic progress with the United States, so things are going pretty well for the kind and just leader of Latveria. But then the knockoff Batman character, the Shroud, shows up, and he is prepared very diligently to defeat, specifically, Dr. Doom. His plan is to make a dramatic first impression as a hero, and at the end of the issue, he does exactly that, believing that he has killed Dr. Doom. But in fact, Doom is alive and well, except that he is now in Atlantis. And as great as that story was, this issue also featured one of the all-time great Hostess ads, especially considering that I read this in early July, and the book itself was published in the bicentennial year of 1976. Let me just say this. Captain America, the Red Skull, the Cosmic Cube, and Twinkies. Now, any writing instructor, any writing course, will tell you that those are the four fundamental building blocks of dramatic storytelling. I didn't check, but I assume that this one page of awesomeness won a few Eisners, to say nothing of well-deserved Peabodys, Pulitzers, and Nobels. And that's to not even mention the letter from future Marvel muckety-muck Ralph Macchio on the letters page. Everything about this issue works. One of my all-time favorite 25-cent reads. I know, I should have saved it for the other show. And Four-Star Spectacular, number 4. Even without the top 1 inch of the cover, I recognized this one immediately as a book that I read a ton growing up. I'm guessing it was in the stack of comics at my aunt's house on the lake that we visited every summer. Looking through Comic Book DB to get some info, I also recognized the covers of issues 3 and 5, so they may have all been in that stack for all I know. And it's books like this, other DC reprints of the era, DC Special, DC Superstars, that really jump-started my interest in comics, and it's what introduced me to a lot of great Silver Age concepts. Now, this issue contains a totally wacky Wonder Woman story from 1943 that revolve around her bracelets of submission being removed, turning her into a whirlwind of destruction and violence. You know, a man. There was a Superboy story from 1958, which was goofy beyond all compare. An idol at a museum can control the weather because of a curse, and then Superboy has to... Okay, here's the thing. Except when he's in the 30th century, hanging out with his super future friends, I don't have much use for the Boy of Steel. There. I said it. There was also a Hawkman story from 1965. I think they count as two, Hawkman and Hawkgirl, to get to the requisite 4 stars in the spectacular. This one wasn't bad. The Hawk's going up against IQ, Ira Quimby. IQ had some device that could turn things invisible or almost invisible, and that gave an opportunity for some cool visuals that still hold up 50 years after the story was first published. And World's Greatest usually does not have Archie digests in the quarter bins, but when they do, I purchase them, including the 128-pager Archie Comics Digests 102 This is from 1990, which is not the best era for Archie and his gang. I far prefer the older stuff to these ones, but this passed the time well enough. I tended to prefer the one-page gags to the 5 or 6-page stories. Those just seemed too stretched, premises too thin, that sort of thing. And by this point, the characters were getting a little bit away from their classic looks, and this, like I said, was the start of a not-so-great era for Archie art. But 128 pages for a quarter, so I think I'll stop complaining. The books, sent in recently by the generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, included Everything's Archie, number 4, a giant size from 1969. Now, this is more the era where these comics were great. Now, the only thing holding this together after 50 years was the masking tape on the spine, and I wonder how long that's been on it. It's a giant-sized book with a variety of stories. There's more Big Moose in it than I needed, and some of the stories featuring the Andrews parents. Now, those were kind of interesting, because I haven't seen a lot of those characters in these books. So all around, another fun read. He also sent Sad Sack's Army Life Parade 19, a Harvey book from 1968, and that was in pretty good shape, actually. No masking tape required. These big Sad Sack books are good, but they do run into the problem of having to tell some repetitive types of stories to fill out the book. There's not the depth of cast that Archie has, but that being said, most of these stories, whether they're 5 pages, 2 pages, or 1 page, end up with a pretty, legitimately funny punchline. And fundamentally, that's all you can really ask for from a comedy book. And Betty and Me, number 30. This is from 1970, and the fashions were definitely and noticeably of that era. And the stories weren't bad either. I've always thought that Betty has a little more variety than Veronica in the terms of the types of stories that work for her. Veronica is a little more one-dimensional, so her stories can get repetitive. But Betty has more interests and interacts better with the broader cast. Of course, her main obsession is Archie, and offering dating advice to whoever asks. But those broad personality traits can fit into a number of different scenarios, such as an obsession with horoscope prediction, or drag racing, or just going to the beach. And those different settings set up different opportunities for jokes and for different types of action. So this one held my attention really well. Fun read. And Reggie's Wise Guy Jokes, number 18. This is from 1971. And like the Sad Sack book mentioned above, it's mostly one-page gag strips. I've had good luck with Archie books like this in the past, but I wasn't sure about focusing on Reggie, like I said above. One of the concerns with these is how repetitive they get, or how many different scenarios the creators can come up with for the character. And Reggie can be a bit of a one-note character, so there was a little bit of that. But again, the Archie cast is broad enough that you can have him interacting with Archie, with Jug, with Betty, with Veronica, with Dilton, with Big Moose, whoever it is. So there was a little bit of repetition, but for the most part, the jokes were funny, and the issue was pretty darn solid. So thank you, Rob. Great variety, great choices. And we're not done with Archie yet, because among the books that Iowa's Joe Crawford recently sent my way was the Betty and Veronica Digest magazine number 119. Now let this be a lesson to anyone mailing comics. Iowa's Joe used the digest-sized books as packing material to keep the rest of the comics from sliding around too much in the box. Genius! Now, this specific digest was, it was okay. It was from 2001, which, again, not prime time for Archie books. Too many characters with very dated 90s hairstyles. And the adventures that B&V find themselves in here, there's just nothing dramatic, nothing that stands out, nothing memorable. It wasn't terrible, but it was certainly not among the better Archie books I've read, or specifically the really good Betting Veronica stories I've read. And Dragon Age Mage Killer number 4. This is a 5-part mini from Dark Horse, working with BioWare and EA. And I've never played any Dragon Age games, don't know the world, but I had hopes because of two words that were on the cover of this issue. Greg and Rucka. And that really helped. I did feel like I knew what was going on and got to know the key characters. It helps that I'm familiar with fantasy settings in general. So even if the particulars were unknown to me, I had the context to put the story into. And despite it being the penultimate issue in a series, stuff happened. And as we all know, that doesn't always happen. So good issue, Greg Rucka. Pathfinder, Hollow Mountain number 5. This is also a penultimate chapter in a Gabe-inspired comic book series. I see what you did there, Iowa's Joe. This one is from 2016, from Dynamite. This issue is mostly a punchy-punchy run-run, along with the necessary role-playing elements of spells and combats and healings. But it just didn't grab me. Again, I'm not familiar with the specifics of the world and story, but I know enough of the general gaming world of RPGs and Pathfinder that I should have been able to follow this better. But it wasn't written by a top-line comic pro like Greg Rucka, and that makes a world of difference. Again, it wasn't bad. It wasn't a bad world or bad format. It just didn't grab me. It was an okay comic book. And The Belfry. This is a one-shot horror story written and drawn by Gabriel Herdman. In the afterword, he specifically says writing this was a chance to take a break from the more serialized, longer-form Invisible Republic book, a way to tell a story that finishes, that wraps up in one issue. And that's in a totally different genre. The story is ostensibly about vampiric bat people in a remote area who cause plane crashes as a way to supply themselves both with victims and with new members of their community. But more than that, it's about a creepy vibe with eerie visuals. You get the idea that he just wanted to draw lots of bat people and came up with a framework, a story, in which he could do that. And given that, it kind of works. It's nice to read a true one-shot every now and then. And Motor Crush, number 1. This is the new Image book from Brendan Fletcher, Cameron Stewart, and Babs Tarr, the former team on the Burnside run of Batgirl. This is a similar story that involves a lady person on a motorcycle. The difference is that our lead character here, Domino Swift, is a professional participant in WGP, the World Grand Prix of Motorcycle Racing, which refers to itself as the world's favorite sport. In addition to the sanctioned type of official racing, a seedy underbelly exists where racers race for the illegal drugs that allow them to race better. So there's a lot going on, some interesting characters, and I like that it's a totally different type of story. But it's a world that I'm not all that interested in. I may pick up the trade if I hear good things about it, but it's not one that I need to rush out and keep reading. All right, time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels.
I'm Mr. Fix-It, and this here is my consigliere, Diablo Frank.
The Lion's Cagliostro.
Same difference. Spawn is one of the most successful comic properties of all time, with best-selling books, animated series, toy lines, and etc.
That stinky movie, all the lawsuits over who has what rights.
Don't be a comedian, Frank. We got business to handle. We're here to pimp out our new show, Spawn Talk, about Todd McFarlane's cursed anti-hero on his fight against the forces of heaven and hell in a doomed quest to be reunited with his beloved wife, Wanda.
No, the show is called The Spawnometer, named after the countdown clock on Al Simmons' Hellspawn supernatural power and undead lifespan.
Yeah, whatever. And the gimmick is we're covering one issue of the comic per episode in 22 minutes or less, 1 minute for each page the comic runs.
Then we'll briefly look at another Image Comics creator or series in roughly chronological order, reflecting a quarter century of creators' rights opportunities at the greatest publisher in the industry.
Then we're going to dump a letter section and some ads at the end of the show, just like Image Comics does. New shows will appear on the Rolled Spine podcast feed through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Shout Engine, and the Internet Archives.
Until we immediately start blowing our deadlines just like Image Comics.
Shut up. Why do you gotta be such a wise guy? That's why you got no friends.
And we're back. At this point, I usually talk about the trades and graphic novels and miniseries and long runs that I read. But I mentioned last episode that there are some great advantages to having a buddy who works at a comic book store. Especially a buddy like the generous Canadian Rob Lance, who also pays very close attention. Back on Quarterbin 98, I talked about the 11 books that I picked up at Free Comic Book Day. And Rob, from the great store, The Comic Connection in Oakville, Ontario, like I said, he listened very closely, and so he sent me every other book from this year's Free Comic Book Day. And I'm going to briefly describe all of those books, roughly in order, from least favorite to most favorite. Time Shifters. This is from Graphic Books, part of the Scholastic imprint. I could see how this could be okay in longer form, but I didn't have enough of the story for it to make sense of me. And as you know from this podcast, I read plenty of all-ages material. But this one just didn't work for me. Exo Manowar. I know. Lots of people love Valiant, and lots of people love this character. But I never got into either the publisher or the character. So this was a lot of mumbo-jumbo to me. Although, to be honest, the Bloodshot preview, that actually did intrigue me a bit. Street Fighter V. I'll talk a little bit more about this property later, but the short version is I've never played the game, and I didn't know they made comic books of the game. And then this one is a wrestling special, and I haven't paid attention to any aspect of wrestling in decades. So this particular issue just wasn't for me. I mean, this was less for me than the Barbie issue was. Barbie. This is from Papercut, which I learned is being editor-in-chiefed by comics veteran Jim Salicrup. And as I just said, I don't mind kids' comics, and I don't mind comics aimed at girls. But this one, again, we're still in the not-for-me category of books. The main story was about contemporary Barbie and her burgeoning career as a fashion designer. Having watched a little Project Runway in my life, that did help, but again, not a story for me. Now, the backup was a shorter story with a futuristic space princess Barbie returning home from space to find that her favorite forests are being cut down. And it's a story I've seen plenty of times, and there wasn't necessarily anything unique in it, but it was better than the lead story. Kid Savage. This is an Image all-ages book, and is an odd but interesting mix. The first half is a prehistoric sort of tale, a young cave boy type of character, gutting monsters with his claw attachments fighting dinosaurs. And then he gets abducted onto a spaceship, which seems to be a sort of family-based scientific vessel. And that's when things get interesting. I can see potential in this one. Again, I like the backup story a lot more. That was about a character named Pix, and there's more about her later. Secret Empire. There was a lot of reasons for me not to like what Marvel, what Nick Spencer's doing with Secret Empire. This intro to the story, to that world, you know, not to my taste. I did like the Spider-Man backup story, a story that leads into the new Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man title. That one featured a fight with the Vulture and an introduction to the new Trapster and had some pretty good Spidey jokes. Hilda's Back. This is from Nobrow Press and is an introduction to a character with a lot of books about her, from what I could tell in the advertising material. But again, I am very far outside the key demographics for this one, and the backups weren't to my taste either. But I really see why this character and this story could work. Riverdale. This is the Archie Comics offering, and it's based on the TV show, obviously. The first story basically tells the story of the flashbacks from the episode, sort of a clip show of the first season, leading up to the July 4th gunshot. The second story is Veronica's backstory, and actually fills in some details that weren't addressed specifically on the show. Miraculous. This is an Action Lab all-ages issue, and the lead story was okay. It was a fine school-based type of story. But again, for me, it was the backup. Kid Sherlock is what moves this up the list. The story takes place at Baker Elementary, and Sherlock is a student there. And one day, a new student shows up, a talking dog named Watson. The other backup, Toyetica, had some interesting things going on in it as well. World's Greatest Cartoonists. This is from Fantagraphics and is rated M for mature. 56 pages of underground and independent creators, most I hadn't heard of, but that's just because those types of cartoons just aren't on my radar screen. But there was some really good stuff in here, no doubt about that. It would have been higher in the countdown, but some of the stories, again, just totally not my thing. I think it was all good, but not all of it was to my taste. 2000 AD. This, again, would have been higher, but it's five stories, and a few things didn't work about some of them as well as the rest did. The Judge Dredd story was solid, as was the Judge Anderson tale. Those were both complete stories that I imagine will lead into later stories. The ones featuring Black Hood, Hope, and Judge Death all had interesting moments, but none grabbed me as complete stories as the other two. So it's like one of those cooking shows where the judges always say to just produce one dish, not two, because if you produce two, it's the weakest of the two that always gets judged. So I guess this comic is as close to Chopped as I'll ever get. That's what I'm saying. Spill Knight. I've never read any of Scott Westerfeld's YA novels, but I know that M read some of the Uglies books, and his Leviathan series is well thought of as well. This one was T for Teen, and that definitely fit right there. This issue serves as a prequel for the upcoming Spill Zone graphic novel, and it sets a tone of weirdness and creepiness really well. It's a type of post-apocalyptic story, or maybe alien invasion story. It's sort of hard to tell. It's what happens when things start pouring in from another dimension. It's a great little world build, and I am intrigued by the upcoming story. The Looking Glass Wars, Crossfire. I did not know that this was part of the Hatter Madigan world, and was glad to learn that it was. This, again, is a world, a universe that I've heard good things about, and was really glad to read this. So it takes place in a Wonderland-inspired world, and is a pretty cool setting. I'm interested in exploring the series, but I need to knock out Fables first, and then maybe make more progress with Grimm Fairy Tales. There's only so much fairy tale-style comic books that one reader can handle at a time. This one is rated T for Teen, for what that's worth. The Descendants. Another fairy tale related book. This one from Tokyo Pop, so it definitely has a manga feel to it. It's based on a Disney Channel movie, so uses Disney related characters. It's the story of the kids, the descendants, of great Disney villains, the daughters of Maleficent and the Evil Queen, and the sons of Jafar and Cruella de Vil. So I think it has potential to be pretty interesting. But again, it's not the type of thing I'm looking for, at least right now, because I have so many other similar-sounding series and stories on the list as well. Colorful Monsters, a Drawn and Quarterly collection. This one features, as the name implies, lots and lots of monsters. This was a long issue, and that always helps, especially when it's all pretty good. There was also such a variety of stories, of art styles, and that also helped. Catalyst Prime. This is from Lion Forge, and is a solid sci-fi concept. The story is The Event, which takes place in an unspecified near future. And the story is about a researcher who discovered an asteroid on a collision course with Earth, and in less than a year organizes a private space launch that will save mankind from this devastation. This one has 28 full pages of story, and we need all of that to get to a satisfying ending of the chapter, while also really setting the stage for the rest of the series. Solid premise, solid character, solid mystery. A really enjoyable read. Fresh off the boat. This is a Boom offering, sort of based on the ABC sitcom about an Asian American family, but it's more of a one-off spin-off. I guess in an episode, a couple of the kids in the series drew a comic book, and this is the story from that comic. Without any context for the characters or the relationships, this just worked. It was funny. And also told a full story. An absolute surprise. And a very pleasant surprise. Another drawn and quarterly book for this year contained two excerpts. First is Hostage by Guy Delisle. That's the cover story. And as the name implies, it recounts the actual experiences of an aid worker kidnapped in Chechnya. And the backup is equally intense, a selection from Bridget Findeclay's memoir, Poppies of Iraq. Drawn in Quarterly specializes in unique work, the types of comics that nobody else does, and this double feature certainly fits that criteria. That book and the next one are ones that, yes, Rob Lance sent, so I could read every 27 free comic book day book. But the great Kanzen Gregor Rujo also sent me these two, the Drawn and Quarterly book above and the next one, because they were among his favorite FCBD books this year. And that second book is The Ballad of Franklin Bonesteel from Z2 Comics. It's a black and white story, but that fits the noir mood of the story. A down-on-his-luck detective who plays a little piano on the side is approached by a client who already owes him money, but if they can get this one job done, the client will have more than enough cash to pay his debt to the detective. The specifics involve songwriting and copyright issues, and that premise gives us a chance to explore the seedy side of the Los Angeles entertainment world. Really good story. Good taste, Greg. Buffy, the high school years. I saw some episodes of the Buffy show back in the day. I actually watched a lot more of Angel. But either way, I'm not part of those fandoms. But this story, which was the first half of this issue, was terrific. Vampires at a comic book store, and a young girl becomes a Buffy fan. The second story was Plants vs. Zombies. I had no idea what was happening, but I guess there was some humor in it. Boom Studios 2017 Summer Blast. This is probably the hardest one to figure out where it should go on this list because it has three totally different stories. It has an excellent Mouse Guard story. Self-contained, poignant, just excellent. And I like the concept of Brave Chef Brianna. More about her later. I like the world, and I've heard good things about that story. So I'm intrigued, but the third was a letdown. This was Cody and the Creepers, broadly from the Lumberjanes world, but it wasn't much of a story for my tastes, at least. If the first two stories were each four pages longer and they dumped the last one, this would have been even higher up on the list. I Hate Image. This was Scotty Young's take on Image Comics, with his character from I Hate Fairyland wandering through many of the comic worlds of Image, beheading characters along the way. Her quest is to find the Image founders so they can tell her how to get home. But her quest, although accomplished in some ways, turns out to be a failure in other ways. Malika, Warrior Queen. This is from Unique Studios and is a pretty good intro for the upcoming OGN. It's a sword and sandal style story about a woman who runs the African Empire of Azaz. She's a good character, it's a good setup, and it's a part of the world that, frankly, you don't see a lot of comic books taking place. And that's partly the mission of the publisher. And that's an interesting idea. And this was a pretty good story to get that line started. The Incal. It's spelled I-N-C-A-L. Not totally sure how to pronounce that. This is from something called Humanoids, but the key to this book is the creators. It was written by Jodorowsky, who you may know from the recent documentary Jodorowsky's Doom, about his attempt in the 1970s to adapt the novel Dune to the screen. And the art is by Mobius, so this is top-level Euro talent, and both men bring their unique strengths to the story. This is the first 25 pages of story, which is futuristic, with a police state and one man trying to reveal a secret that the state does not want revealed. So there's a bit of 1984 in this, as well as other classic sci-fi stories. Really, really strong stuff. Very interesting book. And Bad Machinery. This is from Oni Press, another all-ages issue, and I'm going to just slightly abridge the content from the inside cover. Bad Machinery, from John Allison, tells the stories of three schoolgirl sleuths and their three schoolboy investigators who attend Griswold's Grammar School. In this excerpt, we find our young sleuths facing the intricacies of time and space itself. What is their science teacher hiding? Can Shauna, Lottie, Mildred, Litton, Jack, and Sonny solve the case before time and the universe as they know it unravels? There was so much in this story to like, and I admit I'm a total sucker for junior detective stories, especially if they have a British setting. So this one hit my particular tastes right on the money. That's why it was my favorite free comic book day book of the year. Really enjoyable, and I'd like to take a look at the completed OGN at some point. Okay, that was a lot of free comic book day books. Thanks again, Rob Lance. I'm going to take another break here and then finally talk about all the other comics I read during July. Like I said, there were 5 Saturdays and I'm on summer vacation.
Hello, everyone. My name is Pat, and I'm the host of a new podcast called The Long Box Crusade. A while back, my wife said to me, "Why do you keep buying more comics? I bet you have not even read all the comics you have already." Well, she's right, but let's keep that between you and me. So I took her up on the challenge to read them all. I decided to read my collection of comic books in chronological order by the issue's cover dates. I wanted to relive their adventures and bring back the memories I had of my childhood in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. My collection has been stashed away in over 20 plus long boxes in the basement. I'll leave it up to your imagination as to why I cannot have them on display upstairs, but that's a different story. The Long Box Crusade podcast will be of recaps and reviews of the issues in my collection in a fun and friendly way. You can find the podcast at longboxcrusade.com. I hope you will join me on this crusade to read them all.
And we're back again. I mentioned the Street Fighter book. That was among those free comic book day books. Well, as it turned out, I was Joe Crawford's recent care package included Street Fighter Legends, Cammy, number 1, from last year. I was intrigued by this one because it was written by Jim Zub, one of my favorite young writers in comics. Of course, I have no familiarity with Street Fighters in general, or Cammy in particular, but I did like the special ops aspect to this story. So this was one where the lack of familiarity with the source material was really not a hindrance to enjoying the story. And Street Fighter versus Darkstalkers number 0 from this year. This one, on the other hand, seemed to rely on knowing the world and knowing these characters. I liked the ancient Egypt vibe that was part of the story, but I just couldn't track what was happening enough to enjoy that one. I mentioned above the Kid Savage book that had a backup feature featuring Pix, a YA story about a superpowered girl who believes she is a fairy princess. It worked so much for me that I found her first OGN, Pix, One Weirdest Weekend. Such a nice, light, fun tone, with a story that has harsher undertones. There's a bit of a vibe of the DC superhero girls to this, with that similar mix of fun and adventure. And there's a bit of early high school Spider-Man there as well, with a little bit of Disney princess, maybe, mixed in. Pix lives with her mom and stepdad, and has a trio of good friends who support her and keep her grounded. In terms of the story, there's some mysterious things going on with her powers, from shrinking to turning into a bunny to needing the kiss of a frog prince to restore her. And towards the end of the first volume, questions arise about the true source of Pix's power and who her real father actually is. I also mentioned above Brave Chef Brianna from the Boom Studios Free Comic Book Day book, which led me to pick up Brave Chief Brianna 1 through 4. She is the only sister among 15 brothers, and their dad, a restaurant magnate, celebrity chef, has challenged his children to create the best restaurant. Her problem is that she can only afford to set up shop in Monster City. Yes, that is a city full of monsters who aren't comfortable with humans in general, and human food in particular. But with her positive attitude and excellent recipe, maybe, just maybe, Brianna can turn those attitudes around and forge some human-monster understanding. The story's a little simple, as is the art, but there's such solid details in here, and we really get inside Brianna and her insecurities. So it's really good stuff. And every issue has a recipe at the back. And that's the kind of bonus content that I can totally get behind. Very enjoyable book. And if there's more to come from Brave Chef Brianna, that would be great. And if this is her full, complete story forever and ever, I can be satisfied with that too. And from Hoopla, some new DC, but not Rebirth. Doom Patrol, 1 through 6. This is the new series from Gerard Way and Nick Darrington. It was strange and unusual in the Grant Morrison tradition, and it does try to tie in, or at least reference, prior iterations of the team. So you have Robot Man and Negative Man, who to me are two of the core members of the team. The Chief appears, but does not interact with any of the characters, and there's no Rita Farr. But we do get Flex Mentallo, Crazy Jane, and lots and lots of Danny the Street, or Danny the Ambulance, or Danny World, featuring Danny the Comic Book Store. And, of course, they're very bad people who want to use Danny for their own pretty awful purposes. This is certainly among the stranger, weirder stuff I've read in a long time, and I usually don't respond to weird for weird's sake, but I enjoyed this, and I felt that Wayne Darrington did have a direction. And that's all I can ask for when a story gets strange. I want to know that the creators are still in control of that story. I know that this title has been delayed more than once, much to the concern of Paul Hicks and Mike Garvey, who have done way too much waiting on their Waiting for Doom podcast the last 9 months. I do hope that the title gets back on track on a regular schedule again, and that Wayne Darrington will continue to tell this story. And I read a related title, also from Young Animal, Mother Panic, 1 through 6. This was an odd one, and I was warned that it might not be so good. One of my Twitter buddies, Greg, Ange, Joe, gave up after an issue or so. But I stuck it out, and I'm not really sure why. even now, with some days having passed since I finished it up, I'm still not sure what to make of it. There were parts I liked, the core story of an abused child becoming a heroine, revisiting the horrors of childhood with vengeance in her heart. But the part about this woman having become a pop superstar that so came out of nowhere and did nothing to add anything to the story, I just didn't get that, except that maybe somewhere in these four books overseen by Gerard Way, that concepts of pop music and fandom and paparazzi, all that just had to be worked in somewhere, somehow. I don't know. I don't think I liked putting this in Gotham City either, but then on the other hand, the interactions with Kate Kane were my favorite parts of the issue. So again, I'm just kind of confused about this book. I don't think I liked it, but I think I see potential. I'm not going to run out to read the rest of these right away, but maybe I will someday. Maybe. Maybe. And that brings me to Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye, 1 through 6. This one was a big surprise. I haven't heard much about this title, but I really enjoyed these issues. The stories contain underground exploration, obviously, but also underground civilizations, underground warfare, corporate shenanigans, and a lot of family soap opera stuff. There's an odd mix of intense action, intense emotions, and light, goofy stuff. But it's not jarring. I think the balance is managed pretty well. The only drawback is that the trade does not end with plot resolution. And the presence of, and use of, and importance of, the cybernetic eye, that works as well. This one I'll definitely keep reading. Very enjoyable. We've mentioned Iowa's Joe Crawford's recent care package before. Also in that box was Saga 38, 39, and 41. I had issue 28. I read that for a Quarterbin 100 and enjoyed it well enough, but that was a sort of a side story that did not fit into the main storyline. But here I got a chance to see Alana and Marco and Hazel and Prince Robot and others in the storyline. And this was 3 out of 4 consecutive issues, which was nice. There's a little bit of a break from the Cosmic War, at least for these guys. So these issues are happening on a smaller family-type scale, which is where the series is at its best, from what I understand. I really enjoy BKV's writing, and Fiona Staples is probably the perfect artist for this story, given the nature of what's going on, the nature of the saga. I like this, but maybe it's because I'm picking up later in the series that I'm not pulled into it completely. Like, I'm not on board 100%. I recognize that it's good, but that's a recognition in the head. It's just not gripping me emotionally for some reason. I mentioned my buddy Terry earlier, and I know that he recently blitzed through all of Saga and really dug it. So it's something I may do, but again, I don't know. It's a definitely maybe. Joe also sent some books of a recent Jeff Lemire sci-fi series, between those and Hoopla. I ended up reading Descender 1 through 6. This takes place 10 years after huge robots called Harvesters wreaked havoc across the planets of the United Galactic Council. A young android named Tim-21 wakes up from cryosleep to find that robots have been outlawed. And when he makes his presence known, clashing powerful forces converge upon him. It turns out that this little boy robot, Tim, is somehow, by machine code and computer DNA, that he's related somehow to the Harvesters. He doesn't know how, and neither does anyone else. It's a really nice futuristic sci-fi story. A developed world, a core mystery, well-defined characters. I really enjoyed this one. For one thing, even though it takes place in the wake of this Harvester attack, it doesn't feel like a grim, dark, post-apocalyptic story. It feels like a classic old-school sci-fi story. So I'm definitely interested in checking in on this one down the road and see where the story goes. And the next trade is on Hoopla, so there's a good chance that I will get that chance. Joe also sent another weird one, and Then Emily Was Gone, 2 through 5. It's a five-part mini, 2014, from Comics Tribe. To attempt to summarize the narrative of this is to miss the point, but here it is. A young girl, Emily, disappears, then her friend Fiona disappears, and then someone attempts to rescue them. But the key to this series, to me, is the wacky, crazy art, which does fit the dark and crazy story, which ends up involving a fairy world and witches in a creepy Scottish town. It's all about atmosphere, the creep factor, the eeriness. It was very unlike traditional comic books, but I know what it is, I know what it's trying to do, and it doesn't. I didn't love it, but I appreciate the craft of it in terms of successfully doing what it set out to do. Now, I Was Joe was definitely clearing out his collection, because he also sent Snowblind 1, 3, and 4, so a four-issue mini from Boom, following a family who has moved to Alaska a number of years ago from the South. As the story goes on, we learn, and the couple's only child, a teenage son, also learns, that they are in Alaska as a result of a deal with witness protection. It turns out that the dad is, in fact, one bad dude, and saved his own skin back in Louisiana by turning on the other dudes and his crew of crime dudes, and was rewarded with placement in Witsec, in Alaska. But the son posts one picture of his drunk dad on social media, and the next thing we know, one of the guys from the old days comes gunning for the guy that betrayed them all, which puts the son in the very, let's go with awkward, position. I enjoyed this one a lot. The painterly nature of the art was a good fit for the story. It was a non-traditional art style, but it fit the bleak, cold setting and also set a really good tone, sent the message that this was not a traditional comic book series. So again, good story, good setting, good art, a good little miniseries. I also read Man-Bat 1 through 3. This was a 96 mini written by Chuck Dixon. I love Man-Bat, as faithful listeners may remember, and I really dig Chuck Dixon's writing. And it's that convergence of factors that led me to dig these out of the giant basement of dollar boxes at Pack Rat Comics. As I've said before, Man-Bat is one of my favorite members of the extended Bat family. But I also recognize the limitations inherent in the Man-Bat scenario. So I think he is best served by the occasional mini, and this one was pretty good. Like most of the Man-Bat stories, it involves Kirk returning to Gotham to find Francine. That's long been his core drive, and here it is again. What makes this different is that there's another member of the Langstrom's old cadre of science buddies who is gunning down the rest of their old cadre of science buddies. And you have the Gotham PD tracking down Man-Bat, a pair of police snipers taking shots at him. So there's a different type of drama happening in this story, beyond the standard Jekyll and Hyde or Frankenstein type of drama that his stories always have. Again, solid stuff, a good read. Fables, 146 through 149. One of my goals for the summer is to knock out Fables, and this takes me very, very close to achieving that goal. The Bigby storyline has come to a close, and now we're closing with the inevitable Snow White versus Rose Red clash. This is excellent stuff and a very logical way for the series to conclude. And that's the secret to coming to a conclusion, and that's to give yourself enough room to wrap the story up and to put the pieces in place for that conclusion so it doesn't feel rushed, so it feels natural. And so far, that's what Willingham has done. Only one issue left, and as many of you know, it's a long one. Like, it's a whole trade. Fingers crossed for a satisfying conclusion, based on all that has led up to that final conclusion. As the series has wound down, I have high hopes. Check back, probably next month, for all those details. Another one of my goals for the summer that I did accomplish was finishing up Gotham Central. And reading Gotham Central 32 through 40 knocked that out. This just was an excellent book start to finish. It's, of course, a police procedural set in the dysfunctional, to say the least, police department in the dysfunctional, to say the least, city of Gotham. We do get more interaction with Batman and some other members of the DCU as a number of teen boys turn up dead, all dressed in Robin outfits. And then the end of the series gets wrapped up with a storyline involving the corrupt crime scene man, Jim Corrigan. And all of this is taking place while digging into the personal lives of the main characters. Crispus Allen, Maggie Sawyer, Renee Montoya, Roma Chandler. Obviously, Rucka and Brubaker know how to tell police procedurals. But here, they also show that they can create richly developed characters. And the strain and stress that trying to solve crimes and maintain order in a city that has Batman in it, and then a police department where you can't trust anyone to be on the up and up, the strain and stress is ever present in these issues. Great stuff. I understand that many comic book readers want comics that only feature superheroes, and that's cool if that's you. You're awesome. But if you're someone willing to read a comic that just barely touches, is tangential at best, to the world of superheroes, I highly recommend Gotham Central. I've mentioned before that I loaded up my Nook a while back with a bunch of stuff from the Digital Comic Museum, digitalcomicmuseum.com. These are public domain digital books from the 40s and 50s, and I read some more of those. Catman Comics, 6 through 8. These were from 1942, and the main drawback is something that's common with many, but not all, comics from this era. And that is that in these 64 pages of this book, only 9 were devoted to Catman. So 85% of the book is backups, secondary, tertiary stories, and a bunch of those just aren't at the same level. Now, the Catman stories featuring his young girl sidekick Kitten are uniformly pretty good. Adventurous, action-packed, better-than-average art, very solid reads. Except for the minor technicality that Catman has some unique powers and abilities based on being raised by a wandering tigress in Burma. Don't ask, just accept. But his cousin is just a girl. No Asian cat powers, so that's actually pretty irresponsible. But that's a minor complaint. There's one backup that I like, and it's the story that's usually second in the magazine, and that's the character, the Deacon. He's a churchman with a clerical collar as part of his outfit, and again, pretty good character, fighting injustice and evil wherever it appears. Now, there was a fun story where the Deacon's sidekick and the Catman's sidekick Kitten went to the same summer camp, and they teamed up to thwart evil. It was like a proto-Teen Titans. Beyond that, the features included Ragman, no Chad Bokelman, not that Ragman, Voltan, the Electric Marvel, and then generic stories of military officers, cops, and tough journalists. I have a few more issues of Catman on the Nook, and I'll get back to them at some point. Looking forward to reading some more. I also read Dollman 17 on my Nook, my first Golden Age experience with this character. This was a smaller issue, closer to 40 pages, but very different from Catman, in that 3 of the 4 stories featured Dollman. And I appreciated that. I only know of Dollman from his membership in the Freedom Fighters from their 1970s revival. So this was my first experience with the character in a Golden Age book in his original setting. The stories were uniformly dynamic, action-packed, and adventurous. I liked the way they used his shrinking powers. I'm generally not a fan of shrinking characters. I just think there's some very serious limitations, but I don't know, this may be my favorite version, my favorite take on that power set. And one story in particular deserves attention. It was a supervillain team-up of The Undertaker and Tom Thumb. I didn't know either of these guys, but Dollman did, and that's what counts. And the narration in these stories used my favorite new expression of the year. These two villains collectively were referred to as Plunderworld Chieftains. That was the highlight of the issue. And that phrase may be one of the highlights of my comic book reading for the year. Plunderworld Chieftains. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, there's just so much to choose from. Four-Star Spectacular scratched that nostalgic itch. Doom Patrol was interesting. I read some Saga. Both Gotham Central and Fables are excellent. Wonder Woman 25 was really good. It's a tough call, but the book that sticks with me the most since the time I've read it is probably Gotham Central 40, the final issue of that. It's dramatic, intense, emotional, and was a very satisfying conclusion to a really strong series. Next month, summer break winding down, classes start up, only four Saturdays, so I imagine a much shorter episode. You're welcome. But we won't know for sure until that episode comes out, which should be sometime in early September. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books, the many, many books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And, of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.